Some people just can't leave well enough alone. Consider, for instance, the case of the famous food writer, the one who used the scientific method to take apart everything we know about cooking and put it back together.
If you use vodka in place of some of the water in your pie crust, you end up with a dough that is much flakier and much lighter.
He investigated whether the key ingredient in New York pizza really is the water.
So I did a full double-blind experiment where I got water, starting with perfectly distilled water, and then up to various levels of dissolved solids inside the water. What we basically ended up finding was that the water makes almost no difference compared to other variables in the dough.
He found that the secret to General Tso's chicken lay in geometry.
The geometry of food is important because one of the big things is surface area to volume ratio.
And he explored the relationship between meat and salt. He proved why it's important to salt a hamburger at the last minute, on the surface of the meat.
We rented a baseball pitching machine that would throw hamburgers at the wall at 45 miles per hour. And you'll see that the salted hamburger kind of bounces off the wall like a rubber ball, whereas the burger that has salt only on the outside kind of splatters.
This was the man who finally brought science into the kitchen in a way that non-scientists could appreciate. It helped that his work was fun, not preachy, and delicious. We interviewed him a while back for an episode called Food Plus Science Equals Victory.
I think a lot of people think of science as sort of the opposite of tradition or the opposite of natural, and really it's not.
He had just published his first cookbook, a massive thing called The Food Lab, which went on to win a James Beard Award. His reputation and reach only grew. But then, something else beckoned. Was it opportunity or a trap?
It's that temptation you can't resist.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, the food writer who flew too close to the flame.
My name is James Kenji Lopez Altz. I am a food writer who also happens to run a restaurant right now.
And everything's been going just great, hasn't it?
These problems are insurmountable. Like, how the f*** are we going to fix this?
Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Kenji Lopez Alt grew up in New York in a family of scientists, and he went off to MIT to study biology. He got a little bored, maybe burnout, and during the summers started working in restaurant kitchens in Boston. After college, he worked in an architecture firm for a bit.
For a few months, yeah, like half a year maybe.
And then back to restaurant kitchens.
My very first restaurant job was at a place called Fire and Ice. It's a Mongolian grill, so I was a knight of the round grill. I stood in the middle of a giant cast iron grill and cooked stir-fried food for people and flipped asparagus tips into the air and stuff.
Over the next several years, he worked in a series of higher-end restaurants in Boston.
You know, after that was the end of my culinary career, or my cooking career.
He began building a career as a food writer at Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen. Then, on the food site Serious Eats, he started a column called The Food Lab. He wasn't expecting to turn into a food writing rock star.
I absolutely wasn't expecting it. You know, I was a freelance writer living in a one-bedroom apartment with no windows in Brooklyn at the time.
Now, after doing all that and having that platform and enjoying it, what made you think it was a good idea to not only get back into the restaurant business, but open your own restaurant?
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's that temptation you can't resist. It's like, oh, what if I just went back into the cooking for a little while? Would I be able to do this? You know, so I had a daughter. She's 17 months old now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And when she was born, my wife and I decided that she would continue to work and I would be the at-home parent. So I've been a stay-at-home dad for the last 17 months. You know, about like 6 months into that, I was approached by some friends of friends who owned a bar in San Mateo near where we live. And they were interested in opening up a beer hall and they were looking for a chef partner. And so I thought, oh, you know, this might be something fun I could do in my spare time, which, you know, you don't have too much spare time with a baby on your hands. But thought this could be something fun and this is a good opportunity, relatively low risk. Mainly it was because my wife and I sort of longed for a place like this in San Mateo. Family friendly, casual, upscale place. And that was the concept that they were working on. So it seems sort of perfect for me And initially, I thought my involvement would be relatively minimal. I would work on some menus. I would lend my name to the menu. You know, what was actually really surprising to me was that I when I first signed on with them, I sent a short little tweet saying, hey, like, this is happening. So I'm opening a restaurant, something like that. Eater picked it up. A bunch of other publications picked it up. And then all of a sudden it became... not Kenji Lopez-Alt is partnering with these two guys who are opening a restaurant. It became Kenji Lopez-Alt is opening a restaurant. And then I was like, oh, man, like, I guess I'm really going to get sucked into this.
Okay, so the restaurant is called Wursthal, W-U-R-S-T. So first of all, for those who haven't been to San Mateo, California, just give us a quick sense of the vibe of the place, and then we'll get into the restaurant and why the choices were made to have a German beer hall with sausages.
Yeah, well, San Mateo is a city that's basically dead center between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. My wife works at Google, and so she works down in Silicon Valley. We initially moved up into the city, and her commute was crazy, so we're like, all right, we'll move down to San Mateo. And you know, if you look at sort of the real estate curve, very expensive in very expensive everywhere, but extremely expensive in San Francisco, extremely expensive in Silicon Valley, and San Mateo and a couple of the surrounding cities are like, there's a small dip. So we're like, all right, that's where we can afford to live. And that's where, you know, my wife's commute will be all right. And so I think there's actually a lot of people, in our, situation there right now.
Why a German beer hall? Why was that the right concept, or why was that the concept they wanted?
Well, it's two factors. One of them is the space itself. We're located in a really nice old historic building, lots of nice light. So it seemed very conducive to this beer hall atmosphere. The other thing is that my partner, Adam Simpson, he is really into beer. You know, and finally, beer halls are kind of just popular right now. So it seemed like a concept that worked in the space, that worked with Adam's knowledge base. And it seemed to be something that was hot and kind of lacking in the San Mateo area.
So far, so good, right? So for everyone out there who's thinking, hey, maybe I should open a restaurant, we asked Kenji Lopez-Alt, what's the first step?
So the first step to opening a restaurant is don't. Opening a restaurant is a series of putting out fires every single day. Even once you're open, it's still a series of putting out fires. Step one, don't.
Okay, so can you walk us through the opening process? What kind of work goes into those preparatory weeks, months, I assume?
So the first step is you have to have a reason for people to believe that you're going to succeed and to give you money to do it, because it's not cheap to open a restaurant. And then from there, it's, you know, working with the architects and designers and doing all the build out, which inevitably takes way more time than you expect. And for us, we had this extra problem because we're in this really old building, and the previous tenants and the landlord, they didn't take the best care of the space. You know, but working back from my side, from the kitchen perspective, initially a lot of it was conceptualizing, like, how German do we want to be? How California do we want to be? Because we knew we sort of wanted to do both. Figuring out what the service style was going to be and how customers are going to order. And really thinking to ourselves, all right, like, when people come in here, what are they coming in to do? Initially, you know, when Adam and my other partner, Tyson Mao, when they were thinking of beer hall, they thought, all right, this is going to be essentially a bar. Some people maybe come to have like a nice meal, but most people will be coming to drink and have some food on the side. And that's sort of what the initial menu was designed around. A selection of sausages, a couple sandwiches, some appetizers to share.
So now he got to work creating a menu.
I had developed the initial opening menu on my own in my home kitchen before we had even hired any sort of kitchen staff. I'm pretty methodical, so I had like a recipe booklet written out, everything done in metric units, something that anybody could look at and replicate, you know? Part of the idea was like, because it's going to be relatively low priced and high volume, the kitchen has to be able to sort of run itself, even without like very, very minute oversight.
What about the sausage making itself? I mean, that's a big component. Can you just talk about how involved you were in the design and execution and maybe experimentation and figuring out how to not only make the sausages that you wanted, but how they were going to be prepared?
Yeah, from the start, you know, we knew that we weren't going to be able to make the sausages in-house because we didn't have the facilities. So in order to make a large volume of sausage, you need to have a dedicated refrigerated room where you can grind and mix and stuff and everything. Because if sausage mixture gets too warm while you're forming it, it doesn't bind properly and your sausages end up kind of crumbly and dry. So it was literally like physically impossible for us to make sausages in-house. So very early on, we decided, all right, we're going to have to find some partners to work with who can execute our ideas at a level of quality and volume that we're happy with.
Is that an easy thing to find, someone who can handle that kind of quality and especially volume?
No. I mean, the sausage part was mainly me going to every single sausage maker I could find in the Bay Area. You know, we did want to keep it local. We've, you know, visited many, many butchers and sausage makers, and there are many, many bad sausages around. you know, sausage making is a non-trivial skill. You think, okay, it's just meat and fat, spiced, ground up, stuffed into a casing. Like, how hard could it be? But it's one of these things where, like, the minutiae of the technique can make a huge difference in the quality of the final product. You know, it mainly comes down to the binding element, like making sure that you have the right level of salt and that it's the meat has been salted long enough that the proteins start to dissolve before you mix it, making sure that you mix it right and that you have the right ratio of fat to lean, and then also making sure that it stays chilled through the entire process. And if any one of those things is off, your sausage doesn't bind properly. And that's what you find is the problem with most sort of mediocre sausages. Like, they could be flavored very well. They could be crazy and interesting, but if they're not mixed properly, they kind of crumble instead of having that sort of nice, juicy, snappy texture that I look for in a sausage. And so finding someone who can do that was hard.
There was also the consideration of creating a sausage restaurant that could be vegan-friendly.
So one of my goals from the beginning was, like, vegan items on the menu that are not vegan by omission. They're just vegan by default. And they're delicious, you know. So we have a number of things like that. But the one that I was really excited about is a vegan doner kebab. And for that, I worked with a company called Impossible Meats. They make a vegan ground meat blend, mostly out of wheat protein. But they add heme, which is a... it's a lot of what gives red meat. It's sort of... irony, bloody flavor, but it can also be derived from plant sources. And so it's, like, by far the best sort of faux meat available. And so what we do is we spice it with Turkish spices, so cumin, Urfa Biber chilies, sumac, and then we serve it as a, well, initially what we were doing was we were forming it into a cylinder and doing it in front of one of those doner kebab spits that sort of spins around and you shave it off. But the fat in this stuff is coconut oil, and coconut oil just melts at a slightly lower temperature than animal fat does. So the fat would end up kind of melting out of it and it would just eventually just crumble off the spit. So that didn't end up working. It would have been so cool if we could get that to work. Now we're just forming it straight into, like, sort of hamburger style patties. So all the flavors there.
Okay. So you talked about the food and the building, et cetera. What about the people? How involved were you in hiring and training up kitchen and front of house?
I mean, very involved in back of the house, and finding good people is by far the hardest thing. So when you're living in a place like New York or San Francisco, where the cost of living is so high, finding great people is very hard. Even finding remotely reliable people, even before we opened, when we were training staff, we must have lost probably 50%, 50% turnover over the course of a few weeks.
Wow.
Which is not abnormal, you know? And luckily, you know, it's like one day we're there and, like, two of our cooks don't show up. What do we do? You know, one of them was on a bender and the other one was just a no-show. Luckily, the restaurant down the street, all the cooks there showed up that morning and the manager said, "We're closing, like, you don't have a job anymore." So suddenly we had, like, 12 cooks just walk up to our front door saying, "Hey, can we have a job?" So there's never really a shortage of resumes and applicants. It was finding reliable people that's hard. What I've discovered in my years as a cook, and it played out exactly as expected here, was that it's much better to hire people, like, who give a shit, even if they have no previous experience or skills, than to hire someone who has a great resume who doesn't really understand the concept. You know, our number one kitchen hire, I think, is this guy, Eric Droby, who is a career changer. He was in his 40s. He worked at an office job, always loved cooking on the side, was a food lab follower. He stopped by my house once to give me some sausages he made and some sauerkraut he made because he was proud of them. And they were great. Uh-huh. I thought they were great. And then he said, "Hey, like, I think I've decided I want to be a cook. Would you give me a shot?" I'm like, "Absolutely." Finding people who really care, that's the key, because you can always teach people skills, but you can't teach people to give a shit.
And what about front of the house?
Front of the house is also, it's actually probably even a little bit harder at the start, because you have to really dangle this carrot in front of them, because during training and during the first month that we were doing friends and family meals, people are working and they're getting paid, but they're not getting the same tips that they would. And so they have to realize, okay, like I'm putting in this work now, so in a month I'll be making much more money. But it's hard to find people who are willing to think about that.
So shortly before opening, you tweeted, in all caps, by the way, "Opening a restaurant is insane, and I don't know why anyone in their right mind would choose to do it." So what's going on in the weeks and days just before opening?
I can tell you what was on my head when that tweet went out. It was not actually related directly to the restaurant itself. It was more about its toll on my personal life, and particularly my family life and my marriage, because... restaurant is a harsh mistress. During those 3 months I was in there, I would wake up, take my daughter to daycare, go to the restaurant from 9 a.m. till 4, go pick up my daughter from daycare, bring her home, put her to bed, and then go back to the restaurant from 8 p.m. till 1 a.m. It had been like 2.5 months where I had been basically never at home. You know, I saw my daughter for a few hours a day, but I basically never saw my wife. We lost the chance to sit down and talk together. The only time I ever saw her was when we were with our daughter, so we never really had any alone time. It's very difficult when you're raising a child, like to not be able to talk to your partner, not even have the time to talk about things related to raising the child. And the worst part of it was that no matter how well you plan and you think to yourself, all right, this is the amount of work I'm going to have to put into this restaurant, and I'm just going to say no after that. It's really hard to say no when there's like 40 people whose jobs rely on you making this a success.
Finally, Wursthall was ready for its soft opening. Investors, friends, and family.
About 100 people. And everything was great. We had completely gutted the old bathrooms, retiled them in this beautiful blue tile, really nice wallpaper with these sort of hand pen and ink drawn animals and stuff. It was a really nice bathroom. And the first night we had 100 people in, the toilets backed up, stopped working, and we had to shut down the bathrooms. And as it turns out, the waistline leaving one of the toilets had never been repaired or replaced in probably decades and decades, and had a huge sag in it. And so we had to close for 2 weeks so that they could rip out all the tile we had just put in, dig into the foundation, replace that. All of a sudden, we thought we were going to be ready to open the next week. And now it's like, all right, another 2 weeks and another $30,000 to fix the bathroom that we had never even considered might be a problem.
Coming up after the break, the busted bathroom wasn't the only problem.
It was a disaster. Major, major disaster. Some people were waiting over an hour for their food. Some people never got their food.
And how does a new restaurant deal with bad reviews when literally everyone's a critic?
Basic user 12345 says, "This restaurant was terrible. The potatoes sucked." Well, I don't know what you define as good potatoes, so how is that helpful to me?
That's next, right after this. If you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, you can find every episode going all the way back to 2010 on the Stitcher app and at Freakonomics.com. And you can always listen to the most recent 3 months' worth of episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Okay, Kenji Lopez-Ault, rock star of the food writing world, decided after years on the sidelines to get back into the restaurant business with a place called Wursthall in San Mateo, which started out as a simple concept, a German beer hall serving nouveau-ish sausages.
I was always one of these, I'd rather have influence and bring joy to people than have a lot of money type of career people, you know? And if the money comes along with it, then that's great as well, but I'd rather just be doing something I love.
Okay, so walk us through opening night, and I'm sure everything went exactly as it was planned, and everybody was thrilled, and it was perfect, yes?
Yeah, we had a sizable number of people in there, and that we were cooking food. People were ordering food, tickets were coming in, we were firing it. It was a disaster, like major, major disaster. some people were waiting over an hour for their food. Some people never got their food. It was a kind of night where we're like, these problems are insurmountable. Like, how the f*** are we going to fix this? But, you know, we decided like, all right, we'll focus on like a couple of the big problems first. When I tell them to you, they're going to seem like stupid, small things. It's like, well, why couldn't you just do that? You know, it's like, so one of them was that we have sausages and you get your choice of topping. So one of the problems was communicating to the cooks on the line. So in case you're not aware of how a restaurant kitchen works, there's a line, which is you know, where all the stoves are, where the counters with the little cutting boards are. It's where the cooks, the guys and the girls, are actually making the food. And then there's a station called Expo, the expediter. And the expediter's job is to, first of all, act as the liaison between the front of the house and the back of the house. But more importantly, their expediter's job is to coordinate everybody in the back of the house so that dishes come out at the same time, so that everyone in the back of the house like sort of knows what they're doing. So essentially, they're sort of the general managing the army back there. On opening night, we had all the toppings back on the line. And the expediter was, I was expediting, and I was just calling out, saying like, all right, like one hot Italian with speck and cherry pepper relish, one bratwurst with sauerkraut. And it's a lot of information to take in when you have a full restaurant and there's 100 people there and you're cooking, say, like 25, 30 sausages at a time and each one has their own designated topping. It's a lot of information for the person on the line actually cooking it and plating it to take in. And so every single sausage had this huge delay where, you know, maybe they whipped the wrong topping on it and we'd have to refire it. They would, you know, yell out and everything is really noisy and we can't hear each other. And, you know, and once you have these tiny little problems, that can lead to huge, huge backups because the customers, they don't care what problems you have back there. They want, once they're seated, they want to start ordering food. And they don't care that you already have a full board of tickets and that the grill is completely full. They don't care that you screwed up one order and you have to refire it. Those tickets are just going to keep coming and coming and coming. So you have this ticket printer machine that's spitting out these tickets constantly. And you're constantly struggling to try and catch up with it. And that puts more and more stress on you. So you make more mistakes. The people on the line make more mistakes. And it can be these tiny little things that add to the likelihood of making a mistake that can throw a wrench in the entire operation. And that's essentially what happened that first night. So the second night, what we did was we took those toppings, we took them off the line and put them next to the expediter station, so next to my station, so that all they had to remember was which sausages they were cooking. Then they would pass the sausages to me right before I handed it to a server. I would put the topping on. I had the ticket right in front of me. It was easy for me to read. And that, I mean, it smoothed things over, like, unbelievably so. It's like a couple seconds of extra work on the cook's part. You know, it translated from a sausage taking over an hour to get to a customer because there was like this huge backlog of tickets to customers getting their sausages in about 8 minutes.
There was another major problem they discovered only on opening night.
And it's one that we didn't resolve until relatively recently.
It had to do with the pretzels.
So I'm also a partner at a bakery called Backhaus, and they make all of our pretzels and all of our bread. Really wonderful pretzels, but we serve them hot. So we were trying to figure out, how do we get these pretzels that were baked that morning and delivered to us, how do we serve them hot and fresh? And, you know, the obvious thing is, all right, well, when someone orders a pretzel, put it in the oven, let it get hot, and then we serve it. This was a problem in a couple different ways. One of them was that Backhaus, they were salting their pretzels before they came to us. What happens with pretzel salt is that it draws out moisture from the pretzels. So after 8 hours or so, some of the moisture from the pretzels beads up on the surface of the pretzels, and then it leaves these kind of splotchy, wet marks, which is not good. And the salt is all gone. So we're like, okay, so we have to salt our pretzel sorter. That's adding another layer of stuff we have to do. And the only oven that we have back on the line is next to the fryer station, and the fry guy is extremely busy with the potatoes, and we also do a chicken schnitzel sandwich. And so adding pretzels on top of that to him became very difficult. So for the early nights, we were firing pretzels to order in the oven, and that was another one of those things that like seemed like it's a thing that takes 2 seconds, but it just piled on to the likelihood that we were going to screw something up.
So what was the pretzel salting solution?
Well, we found a much more efficient way of salting them. So one of the cooks had this idea to take a squeeze bottle, cut off the top until it was big enough that pretzel salt could flow through it. And now what we do is we just spray the pretzels and draw a line, you know, trace the outline with the squeeze bottle, and that clears up all the space.
I'm curious how much you pay attention to, I guess, reviews of any sort. I mean, if you'd open a restaurant 10, certainly 20 years ago, there's so much less feedback then. And now some people feel swamped by it. Some people feel a lot of it is disingenuous. I know you've said in the past that Yelp, in fact, this is from a tweet of yours. Yelp is and has always been the worst place to look for decent reviews. Shady business practices and reviews by people who I know nothing about and have no reason to trust their opinion, even on the off chance they actually dined at the restaurant you're rating. So talk about that for a minute, your experience with Yelp and or other online reviews.
So it's difficult to gain value from them for me.
You mean as a consumer or a producer?
As a consumer. I mean, to some degree, you know, as a producer, there is a little bit of value to it. But especially if you start looking at trends and see, all right, the people who are complaining, what are they complaining about? You know, at the beginning when we opened, it was service. And that was, some very legitimate feedback on that.
You didn't need online reviews to know that was a problem, I gather, right?
We did not need online reviews. There's very little that I've seen in Yelp that we didn't already realize was a problem. You know, as a consumer of Yelp, I find Yelp useful as a map of what restaurants are around. But it's hard to trust opinions. A very good professional review, like, you don't necessarily have to agree with the reviewer's point of view on what is good and what's not. But if you have an idea of what they think is good, then they tell you whether this restaurant met those expectations. And then you can sort of gauge, all right, well, do I agree with whether that's good or not? And that's what a good restaurant review will do. Whereas on Yelp, it's like someone, basic user 12345, says, this restaurant was terrible, the potatoes sucked. It's like, well... I don't know what you define as good potatoes, so how is that helpful to me, you know?
The problem is that everybody eats, right? So everybody considers himself, I guess, a legitimate critic, which...
Yeah.
And I mean, you can't totally discount that fact, can you?
No, you can't. You know, but at the end of the day, it's like, you know, I'm involved in this project because I want to be, I want to have my name on it, I want to be proud of what we're putting out. And so at some point, you just have to sort of stick to your guns and say... This is what I believe is good, and I'm not going to change that just because some people say they disagree that it's good. And if your idea of what is good is so far off from what most people think is good, then maybe you're in trouble and you're going to go out of business. But I'm of the mind that I'd rather lose a little business and stick to what I believe is true than to just pander to everybody to try and make the most money or... you know, which is hard to explain to partners and investors. But at the end of the day, you know, like as a food writer, I think I do have a pretty good pulse of what people think is good.
Right. So overall on Yelp, Worst Hall is doing pretty well, averaging about 3.5 out of 5 stars. So let me read you one Yelp review and hear your response.
Okay. I honestly haven't looked at Yelp reviews since like the second month after we opened. So we'll see.
This is from just over a month ago. This is from Andrew R. He writes, I was really disappointed. I expected more. Not that I had high expectations. They were modest, honestly, but it fell below that bar as well. For one, the service was not that great. For two, the food just isn't that good. It's okay, like you would eat it if you were hungry, but another sausage would probably satisfy you more. And I like a split top bun because you can grill both sides like they do here, but when it's split only halfway down, there's a lot of bread with no meat at the bottom, and that's terrible. Cut that bun all the way down. It'll be better. Trust me. So that's Andrew R. What does Kenji L. say?
Well, I'll start from the end of it and work back. Believe it or not, we tested how far to cut the bun extensively before opening. And trust me when I say it's not better to cut it too far because the buns end up falling apart. It doesn't stand right. That sounds all fair, you know, like those seem like legitimate concerns. If I was at the restaurant, I would definitely have loved to talk to them and gotten a little more details about exactly what they were disappointed with. What is it about the sausage that you didn't like? And to his point about, you know, sausages being not great, you know, yeah, I fully admit sometimes, like any restaurant or any business, we have consistency issues now and then, and we work our best to make sure that those don't happen. And every day gets better.
Okay, here's a professional review. This is Peter Lawrence Kane in SF Weekly. He writes, the quality of the food is high and it is consistent. The thing is, considering Lopez Alt's eminently well-deserved reputation for being a demystifier of culinary techniques, Worst Hall feels a little short of the gosh wow factor longtime fans might clamor for. Maybe that's not entirely fair. After all, it's exactly what it claims to be. What's your take on that, Kenji?
So I fully agree with that. This is, again, one of those things where it's like, what happened to the restaurant between the initial concept and what customers expect? And the initial concept was like, all right, we're going to serve some damn good sausages. We're going to make our own sauerkraut. It's going to be good sauerkraut, but it's still sausages and sauerkraut, you know, and there's only so far that can go, you know, as far as like gosh darn wow factor. This is one of those things where the concept of the restaurant on paper turned out very different from what the restaurant is now. Once my name got attached to it and there started being this sort of media attention to it, it turns out people are coming there for dinner. They're not coming there to drink. We started as a beer hall, but we're not really a beer hall anymore. We're a restaurant. You know, that's been one of the challenges since opening, is like coming to terms with that and realizing, you know what, like some of the stuff we initially thought isn't going to work because customers are coming in with different expectations. Any restaurant takes a while to find its legs. I think for us, maybe it's taken a little bit longer just because it was such a big shift from what we had initially planned compared to what customers perceive.
I see that maybe yesterday or within the last little while, you tweeted a new menu item that's starting soon. Maybe it's already started by now.
Started today.
Okay, congratulations.
So I was at the restaurant all morning, you know, training the staff and making sure that the cooks knew how it worked.
So this is tomato mayo toast with grilled corn vinaigrette and a corn soup with paprika oil and shishito peppers. So that's not what I think of as beer hall food. Was it the clientele who drove it primarily? In other words, were people confused when they came originally because they know your name and they think it was going to be more of a sit-down knife and fork situation?
You know, I think that's part of it. I definitely saw comments saying, like, I expected the menu to be a little more Kenji than what it is, you know, because it's like sausages, like, I don't write that much about sausages. I don't eat that many sausages. I like them and we cook them well, but it doesn't exactly like scream Kenji or Food Lab or whatever. So yeah, so part of this revamping process has been like, all right, how do we make this menu more me?
So from what I've read, you own 12% of the restaurant and 20% of any new venture with these partners?
It's something like that. Yeah, that's ballpark correct.
Would you have had the same share of ownership had you just acted as a sort of consulting founding chef as opposed to roll up your sleeves fully involved?
No. My partners are actually very understanding of, you know, the entire situation and the fact that I'm now what got more involved than I was planning on. And so actually, you know, initially, like, it was going to be basically just a fee plus a smaller percentage of ownership.
The big question I have then really is, so far, do you feel overall that it's worth it? And I guess another way of putting that is, you know, if I came to you tomorrow, Kenji, with an idea that you liked, an idea for a restaurant, maybe a site for a restaurant, and a potentially worthwhile partnership, what do you do? Do you succumb or do you refrain this time?
I would say the restaurant on its own in a bubble, like detached from every other part of my life, absolutely worth it. I don't mind putting in hours and hours and hours of work, even for little to no play. You know, like, I haven't made any money off this restaurant yet, and I don't plan on making any money for a while until we pay off all our investors. But, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. So if someone came to me right now and asked me if I wanted to do this restaurant again, I would probably say no, only because it cost me 3 months of being with my daughter. And that was, you know, a price that I wasn't expecting to have to pay at the beginning, and one that made me deeply sad as it was happening, and also in retrospect. So I don't regret anything I did with the restaurant. I do regret how it affected my personal life and my family. But we learned those lessons.
Okay, final question. Let's say that maybe this is when your daughter is in school. Maybe this is when your daughter's in college even. But let's say I come to you and I want you to work with me to open a new restaurant. What is the dream concept, whether it's cuisine or style or location? Like, what is the restaurant that you absolutely would sacrifice again almost your entire life to do?
It would be something much smaller than Worst Hall. So we're opening a couple more Worst Halls in the coming years, but we've talked about other restaurant concepts as well. And I think if we were to work on something together again, it would be something much smaller. The idea I've been throwing out at them is a Korean fried chicken sandwich place, which is a recipe that I've done at a number of pop-ups. I think is extremely delicious, but it's essentially, you know, chicken brined in kimchi juice and then done sort of like a Nashville hot chicken style. But instead of the Nashville hot chicken oil that goes on there, we make like a sauce with Korean chili flakes and a bunch of different Korean flavors. And it's super delicious. And the kind of thing that I think would do well is a fast casual thing. You know, that would basically be it for me. Like, I want to feed a lot of people and make them happy. You know, I don't want to open like an ego restaurant. I don't want people to come to, you know, worship at the altar of Kenji Lopez all come for this experience. I want a place that, you know, people say, hey, that's a good sandwich. I'm going to have that once a week.
That was Kenji Lopez Alt. His new restaurant, Worst Hall, is in San Mateo, California. His book is called The Food Lab. He's currently working on a follow-up, so keep your eyes out for that. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, is it really true that Scandinavia is the happiest place on Earth?
There's maybe I'd have said a 6 was a good day in London, and now I'm generally on that 8, and sometimes it's a 9 if I'm lucky.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Stitcher or at freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive money internationally. And their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Until a few years ago, Helen Russell was leading a seemingly happy life in London, working as an editor for the fashion magazine Marie Claire. True, she did feel restless at times. Also true, she and her husband had been struggling with fertility treatments. That said, she had no intention of leaving the UK.
Until out of the blue, one wet Wednesday, my husband came home and told me he'd been offered his dream job working for Lego in Denmark. And we knew nothing about the country, as many people in other countries are fairly ignorant of Scandinavia. We couldn't really have pinpointed it on a map.
They decided to go for it. But as soon as they arrived, in a small town in the rural hinterlands of Denmark, in the dead of winter, she had regrets.
My husband left to go to work at 7:30 a.m. I didn't know anyone. I didn't speak the language. I was in this freezing cold, dark country all by myself. I did a lot of howling at the moon, thinking I'd made the biggest mistake ever. And I did a lot of eating Danish pastries, because as a repressed Brit, I like to eat my emotions.
But Russell had heard, as you may have heard, that Denmark is routinely at or near the very top of the annual happiness ranking compiled by the United Nations. And the other Nordic countries, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, and Finland, pretty much dominate the top 10. Russell naturally wondered why. What are the causes and consequences of this alleged happiness epidemic? Was it for real? What are the downsides? She set out to answer these questions in a book she called The Year of Living Danishly, Uncovering the Secrets of the World's Happiest Country. Along the way, she asked nearly every Dane she met how they would rank their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. A funny thing happened during this process. Russell herself became quite a bit happier.
I was maybe I'd have said a 6 was a good day in London, and now I'm generally on that 8, and sometimes it's a 9 if I'm lucky.
You're practically Danish, yeah.
Practically Danish.
I recently spent a few days in Copenhagen. There was one person I was very excited to meet.
So my name is Mike Viking, and I'm the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute here in Copenhagen.
And is Viking a common surname here?
No. So I think we're a handful of people called Viking. My dad is called Wolf Viking.
Wow.
I have a brother called Kenneth. I have a couple of nephews. One of them is called Max Viking. Wow. So he really needs to grow up big and tall.
Do you do Halloween here? Were you dress up as costumes? I'm just curious.
I see where this is going.
Were you a Viking every year when you were a child?
No, but there was one episode, yes.
Viking has a background in political science, economics, and sociology, all of which figure in understanding what's called happiness.
I mean, one of the challenges we have with happiness is, of course, to define it and to measure it. And we should first and foremost acknowledge that it's a wide umbrella term. So you have one understanding of what happiness is, and I have another one. So we need to break it down and look at different components. So the first is an overall life satisfaction. And here you essentially ask your respondents to take a step back and evaluate your life.
Happiness researchers also track people's moods in the moment.
How happy are you right now? Or how happy were you yesterday? And there we can see that weather, what day of the week it is, impacts our happiness levels. People are happier, no big surprise, on the weekend than they are on Monday mornings.
They also measure people's sense of meaning.
that builds on what Aristotle thought the good life was. So to him, the good life was the meaningful life. So here we try to understand, do people have a sense of purpose?
A sense of purpose, a self-evaluation of life satisfaction. You may think all this sounds a bit squishy, especially to an economist, yes?
I'm going to answer anything you're going to ask me.
Okay, we'll ask some questions. First one's easy. Would you please introduce yourself?
Jeff Sachs, a university professor at Columbia University, and I am special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General on the Sustainable Development Goals. One part of that is human well-being, and so I am a co-editor each year of the World Happiness Report.
The World Happiness Report, that's where Denmark and the other Nordic countries always come out on top. Jeff Sachs, just so you know, isn't some woo-woo feel-good witch doctor. You may have heard him on our program before talking about his work as an interventional economist for governments in crisis.
I worked in Poland and in Russia after the communist system collapsed.
Also in Bolivia, trying to tame its hyperinflation.
And I worked in Latin America very extensively for several years after the work in Bolivia until
the calls kept coming.
And then in 1995, another quite decisive turn for me was an invitation to go to Zambia and to see what this experience and these lessons might mean for Africa.
Over time, and because of those experiences, Sachs came to believe that his fellow economists had left something out of their worldview. Something, in fact, quite vital.
The economics profession took a very bad turn roughly 150 years ago when it decided that since it wasn't possible to measure happiness or to compare happiness across individuals, we would look basically at consumer preferences.
The inspiration to incorporate happiness into economic modeling came from a rather unlikely source.
So back in 1971, the fourth king of Bhutan, who also brought democracy to the country, and it was an extremely, extremely wise leader, he raised the question already, why are we pursuing gross national product when we should be pursuing gross national happiness? It was such a wonderful phrase, and GNH entered the vocabulary of a small niche of economists and a small niche of Buddhists and others who were dreaming of this already decades ago. But Bhutan went ahead as a very poor country and actually set up the mechanisms for detailed survey measurement of dimensions of gross national happiness. It set up a gross national happiness commission. It ordered that all legislation should be evaluated, a kind of happiness benefit cost ratio.
Sachs began meeting with the king, and they brought more world leaders and economists into the happiness conversation. This ultimately led to the creation of the UN's World Happiness Report. The concept was jarring to many of Sachs's colleagues, particularly in the U.S.
Well, in our country, we don't talk about almost anything else in the public space. It's all about growth, GDP, incomes, of course. There is a massive industry of happiness studies, self-help manuals, helping people to overcome all sorts of unhappinesses, trying to help people find meaning in their lives, trying to help people make better decisions about their lives.
To Sachs, the booming self-help industry in rich countries like the U.S. reveals a disturbing paradox.
We have the paradox that income per person rises in the United States, but happiness does not. It's not that that's because humans are humans. It's because the U.S. is falling behind other countries because we are not pursuing dimensions of happiness that are extremely important. Our physical health, the mental health in our community, the social support, the honesty in government, and this is weighing down American well-being.
Like the Danish happiness expert Mike Viking, Sachs finds wisdom in the ancient Greek model.
I go with Aristotle. He's my guy. He's my favorite philosopher. And he pointed out in the Nicomachean Ethics 2,300 years ago that to be happy requires the good benefit of having material needs met. So don't deny those, he said. But he also said only aiming for wealth, single-mindedly pursuing a higher wealth is certainly no way to happiness. And after a certain point of income, work on other things. Work on your friendship. Work on your mental health. Work on your physical health. Work on good governance. Work on your charitableness. Because in this kind of world, a good life is a balanced and a virtuous life, not a single-minded pursuit of income.
Okay, if these are the factors that supposedly generate happiness, community, good mental and physical health, good governance, and since Denmark and the other Nordic countries top the happiness rankings, let's take a look at how they address those factors. Let's start with the social safety net. Mike Viking again.
There is obviously universal healthcare. There's also free university education. In fact, now it's
up through university. Along from the lower level too. It's always
yes,
free.
Yeah. So heavily subsidized kindergarten, primary school free, high school free, and university free, and you get a government grant, and that creates also a lot of social mobility.
So there's does healthcare not being tied to a job, which we have mostly in the States.
Exactly.
Danes also work fewer hours, on average 27.6 hours per week, compared to 34.4 in the U.S. To Helen Russell, moving here from Britain, that was a big change.
There's no stigma to clocking off. People work mainly from 8 till 4 in offices. There's no stigma to leaving at 4 because you've got to go and pick up your kids from daycare, you've got to go and make supper, or you just need to get on with your hobbies.
Denmark strives toward egalitarianism on the gender front, and its parental leave policies are famously generous.
So there's 52 weeks, both parents can share it between them, and you can defer, I think it's 13 weeks of this, for I believe it's up to 8 or possibly 9 years. So I have a friend whose family she has two children, and the youngest one is now 5, but she's taking 13 weeks off next year to go on a big trip around Australia. And I was outraged by this. I think, oh my goodness, isn't this sort of taking the mick a little bit? She said, no, it's perfectly acceptable here. It's just a different mindset, I guess.
The basic idea of social democracy is to pay attention to social cohesion, to provide ample social goods like healthcare available automatically for all, education at all levels available for all, vacation time available for all.
Jeff Sachs argues this strong social support in the Nordic model contributes to a number of healthy outcomes.
The life expectancy is higher. Our obesity epidemic does not exist in those countries. Our opioid epidemic does not exist in those countries.
There is also a high level of trust towards the government. And that goes hand in hand with the Nordic countries being at the low end when it comes to corruption or perceived corruption. We have a different perception of the state. So what I see from over here, you feel you need to be protected from the state. Is that a fair assumption?
It's a fair assumption for a significant fraction, at least, of Americans,
right.
Let's say. Not all, certainly, okay. But yeah.
And people in the Nordic countries will feel that the state protects us from things. The high level of social security is one element that there is a notion that if you fall, you will be picked up. So I think we see more the state on our side and helping us create good conditions for good lives.
Scandinavia also gets high marks on interpersonal social trust.
So if you ask Danes and Norwegians and Swedes, do you feel that most people can be trusted, or can't you become too careful when it comes to strangers?
Right.
3 out of 4 will say yes, right. You can trust most strangers. The global average is 1 in 4.
So you may have heard of, there was a story in New York a few years ago of a Danish woman who was there, who left her child sleeping outside in a pram, which is what you do in Denmark, and was arrested for child neglect. And lots of people in Denmark didn't understand why it was such a fuss, because in Denmark, people trust most people. And this plays into everything. You're not anxious if you trust the people around you. You're not scared they're going to rob you to put food on their table.
And have you become more trusting as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to reveal too much about where I live, but I regularly forget to lock car and or house.
But considering the very high level of support in Denmark for citizens from prenatal, really, until literally after death, my question, which is maybe unanswerable, is would you say that the very high level of social trust is a result of such a generous social security system, or the cause of it?
That's a really interesting question, and it's something that academics in Denmark are still very much grappling with. Some of the economists that I spoke to for the Year of Living Danishly put it that actually these high levels of trust have been here that predate the social services and the social welfare system. Other people argue it's the other way around. There's something interesting about the experience of living Danishly that increases your levels of trust. So immigrants to Denmark also end up adopting Danish values, or their levels of trust rise as the experience of being around Danes and being in this environment starts to sort of filter in and bed down. So it's a real debate, actually. There's a bit of both.
Russell enumerates several other factors that may contribute to a relatively high state of Danish happiness. Most people belong to at least a few clubs or community groups. They spend a lot of time on fitness and outdoor activities, and they don't put too much emphasis on material possessions.
Yes, it's frowned upon to flash your wealth, to flash your success.
Mike Viking again.
That is quite common in the Nordic countries. So it also sort of puts a lid on conspicuous consumption.
So do you believe that that is a driver, major or minor, of overall happiness, that people feel less compelled to compare themselves to others?
Yes, a minor one, but I think it's one. And yeah, I mean, there's so many studies out there that show that inequality is bad for health, for crime rates, for murder rates, and all sorts of things.
It's really interesting. So I was literally this morning, I'd just come from an independent coffee bar, and there's an equality there. There is not a difference between the person who is serving me coffee and the person buying the coffee. You can talk as equals because you know that you are both probably after tax taking home around about the same amount, and everybody is having a sort of decent life. On the flip side, there's not the same service culture. I was just back in the UK for work, and oh my goodness, everyone was so nice to me. And when I go to the States, I mean, that's even more so. And then I have to remind myself, oh, they're being nice to me because there's a financial imperative. And of course, there is more of a service culture in some places than others. In Denmark, that's not the case. I mean, you don't expect bells and whistles, but I'm kind of fine with that now.
There is one more Danish attribute that's said to greatly contribute to happiness. It's spelled H-Y-G-G-E.
So it's pronounced hygge.
Hygge.
Well done. So I think the best explanation of what hygge is the art of creating a nice atmosphere. So it's about togetherness, it's about pleasure, it's about warmth, it's about relaxation. And that is a key cornerstone of Danish culture. To Danes, hygge is what freedom perhaps is to the Americans.
But I gather there are also, you know, physical components of it that are specific. A lot of candles, or
right.
good lighting, and
yes.
good pastries, and
right.
so on.
Yeah. yeah.
So, pillows.
So because hygge is about an atmosphere, lighting is important. Lamps are important. Candles are crucial. So Danes burn twice as much candle wax as number two in Europe, mm-hmm. which is Austria.
Viking is the author of an international bestseller called The Little Book of Hygge.
And I receive a lot of letters from readers saying, I've been having hygge all my life. I just didn't know there was a word for it. So I think what we did with hygge was we gave a word or a language for people to appreciate something they were already doing.
It's in every area of Danish life. And I'm working with the UNESCO right now to get it put on the World Heritage Intangibles list. Studies show that if you're practicing hygge, it's a bit like self-kindness, but without the woo. And it makes you nicer to the other people. And this has a ripple effect out into society. So it really does contribute to happiness.
Coming up next week, we'll continue this story and ask the all-important question. What if all that hygge just isn't happening for you?
If everybody around you feels that life is great, then that could create a stronger contrast, and maybe you start to blame yourself.
And how do Denmark and its neighbors feel about sharing their happiness, especially with immigrants?
Scandinavia has, yeah, we love our social democracy, but it's just for us.
That's next week on Freakonomics Radio. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire podcast archive at freakonomics.com or on Stitcher. And you can always subscribe and listen to the latest 3 months of episodes on any podcast platform.